should drop it. This power panel. We're going to go 2 hours of this power panel. Michael Schur, Jay Heuer, Amna Nawaz, John Iadarola, and I know what you're thinking. Who the hell's John Iadarola?
I'm not sure I know.
Shut the words right out.
Are we all? Really?
Amna Nawaz is an Emmy award-winning anchor and reporter on ABC News. Not a big deal, please. digital and live stream, host of Uncomfortable, program I was on, yes. And which you should all check out.
Yes.
She did make me slightly uncomfortable, but I have promised to return the favor here today. Yeah. So
I don't remember agreeing to that. And in my defense, the show is called Uncomfortable.
Agreed. So. Agreed. What That's a great defense.
One moment when you were uncomfortable.
Okay, I say it, but really, is there almost anything that could make me uncomfortable?
I was going to say.
Every once in a while, somebody will be apologetic before they ask something. I'm like, let's get on with it.
No, I've done this.
Yeah, it's okay. God bless.
Firing John has made you uncomfortable for years.
Yeah, and he just keeps coming back.
Yeah, it's weird.
Okay, so a dramatic moment in this show will be when it appears that I am massively wrong.
Ooh. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but they don't.
Okay. We'll find out.
So it appears today that we have a very, very rare situation where I'm wrong.
That's where you're wrong, actually.
Again, rare. There it is again.
Now. Really
So
now I'm uncomfortable.
So we'll see if that sticks. But for the moment being, today we got to say it, and it's on a big issue. It's on a gigantic issue, and it actually affects the Trump administration in ways that will make me change my entire prediction about them. Whoa.
Might vote for them in a couple years.
I wouldn't go that far. All right, so, and then there are some issues in today's show where we might have significant disagreement on the panel. And I look forward to that. Okay.
And so, Jimmy's not here.
And Jimmy's not even here. That's right. It drops.
Still recovering from 420.
Right. Oh, speaking of which, we do have the fun. Is the 420 sale still happening or ended? No, sorry. If you just smoked your way out of it and forgot about it, well, that's the price you pay for smoking. Okay.
But wait a year.
You had a sale for 420?
Of course. We have a 420 shirt. And my 4-year-old daughter was like, oh, pretty, pretty flowers. I'm like, not exactly, but I like that you think of them as pretty flowers. Oh, there it is, that's right. Well, they can't see it.
Oh, yeah, those are pretty flowers.
Okay, so we do have this, by the way. Ooh, what is House TYT?
What does it say on the back?
Shockingly enough, TYT.
Okay.
I'm not sure it says anything in the back. Anyway, this is for the journalism campaign. We're trying to hire brilliant journalists like Amna. And if you donate $127 in NPR kind of style, you will get this as a perk. House TYT, this is only limited time for this campaign. And there's only 8 days left because it is the first 100 days of Donald Trump that we did the campaign through. And in fact, we have a story about the first 100 days on whether he delivered on his promises or not. A little bit of a mixed bag, as you're probably not surprised by that. And so let's get started. All right, John, what do you got?
Okay, gonna be starting off on a somber note. Yesterday, a French national opened fire with a machine gun on a police van on the Champs-Élysées, killing one officer, Xavier Jugele. Officers engaged the attacker in a shootout in which two officers were wounded and the attacker was eventually killed. We want to tell you a little bit about his background because immediately in the aftermath, very shortly after, just a couple of hours after the shooting, ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack. And I have seen reports, although it doesn't seem definitive, that there was some sort of literature found in the scene defending ISIS. So it does appear that it was affiliated in some fashion with ISIS. But the same gentleman back in 2005 was convicted on 3 counts of attempted murder. France 24 reports that 2 of the targets back 12 years ago were police officers. More recently, police had been watching him as a potential terrorism suspect, as they watch so many. Of course, it's always extremely unfortunate when an act like this happens and you find out that they were worried about this individual. Unfortunately, nothing was done in this case. Now, as I said, ISIS claimed responsibility through its official propaganda outlet just a couple of hours after. Now, what's interesting about this is that this person does seem, in the propaganda that they had on their person, to have been affiliated with ISIS. But we also know that going back more than a decade before the birth of ISIS. They had been attempting very similar acts. And so while it appears that this was an act of terror in which a police officer unfortunately lost their life and others were wounded, it also seems like in many other cases that this is a person who had significant mental issues, had a criminal past, and then eventually began to be affiliated with ISIS. They have been looking in the background and they haven't found any other outward statements in support of ISIS or anything like that yet that could be forthcoming. But it is interesting, and we'll get into the political ramifications domestically for France in just a little bit.
Yeah, from an international perspective as to this ramifications, that's an interesting conversation. So first, I don't think it's that interesting a question as to whether it's terrorism. Almost certainly it is, and okay, check, we did it. So it appears to be Islamic radical terrorists. Okay, there that was said, hopefully that'll solve it soon. It doesn't seem to have worked yet, and even the president said it still hasn't worked. So I know that under Obama, these would be blamed on how Democrats were too soft and everybody else was too soft. Doesn't seem to be sticking out Trump. Trump seems, if anything, almost celebratory of it, saying that yes, this will probably affect the French elections. I mean, I'm sorry to see it happen, right? Okay, now we know for a fact that terrorism, not just homicides, not just crime, but terrorism is much lower today than it was, for example, in the 1970s. 1970s in Europe, we had the Baas separatists, we had the IRA, we had much higher incidence of terrorism. Did we invade Ireland? Well, the UK and Ireland had a lot of propaganda and had a lot of conflict there, and obviously in other places as well. The question is, what do you do once you've labeled it as terrorism? And unfortunately, there isn't much to do here. ISIS has won the branding contest between ISIS and Al-Qaeda. They used to say, I'm with Al-Qaeda. Now they say, yeah, I'm with ISIS. And ISIS seems to be more connected to this than others. Some of the other attacks, they even timed it out. It usually takes them 10 hours to take responsibility. And this one, they did it in record time in 2.5 hours. And there might have been conversations with ISIS back and forth, which lately there hasn't been. It's just BS, I guess I'm with ISIS. This one seems more real in that they might have actually even communicated. But what do you do with that fact? We're already bombing ISIS into oblivion, and we're already getting ready to take on Raqqa with the help of allies on the ground. Okay, what do we do next? And I'm not sure there's a great answer.
Well, you make sure that somebody who is convicted of 2 counts of attempted murder is not able to buy a gun so quickly in the first place. I mean, that to me is the egregious understory here, is that this guy was out of jail. He was convicted of attempted murder on 2 police officers, and he's got a gun, and he's in the streets. So I think that's a good place to start, forgetting the terrorism. I mean, the other thing that we've talked about this before, but can a Muslim just commit a crime, a Muslim person just commit a crime anymore, or is it always terrorism?
Well, that was more of an interesting question recently in Fresno.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Where they're like, okay, was it racism or was it terrorism?
Right.
I would argue that it's both, because I have a narrower and a broader definition of terrorism. What I mean by that is, I think we way overuse terrorism. So now everybody who's an enemy of ours is terrorist, and then everyone across the world has adopted it. So in Turkey, for example, Erdogan calls even journalists who write against them as terrorists. Mm. Putin calls everybody who's against them a terrorist. The most overused
people against
word.
The referendum were terrorists.
That's right, in Turkey. That's right. Outrageous, ridiculous use of the word, started by us here in America. On the other hand, what I mean by broader is the right wing terrorists here in America that murder cops, that murder black people in churches, that shoot up Jewish Holocaust museums, obviously are terrorists,
right?
The same way that Muslims are terrorists. But the media is amazing. When it's a Muslim, immediate conversation, is it terrorism? And usually it's not even a conversation, usually it just is, right? And then they don't even have the conversation when a right wing does it, or the guy who was just arrested with 1,000 rounds of ammunition who was going to shoot everybody up who's a sovereign citizen. When you're going to shoot and murder innocent civilians, and you're doing it for a political purpose, if that's not terrorism, then we should absolutely stop using the word.
Yeah. I think as they figure out, the investigation is obviously in the early days, but as they figure out what those links are here, the problem is these days, if ISIS can claim responsibility, because it works for ISIS to claim responsibility every time, whether they had something to do with it or not. Right. as they figure out whether there was any support and preparation or training beyond just I went online and saw some videos and got inspired to act, then that's a point of concern. But the other problem is our vocabulary and the way we talk about these security threats hasn't changed, hasn't shifted from the foreign narrative. So we're constantly talking about Raqqa and, you know, the battles out in other countries, whereas most of these attacks are now happening from people who were born and raised in those countries.
Right. Yeah.
This was a Frenchman,
right.
Exactly. You know?
Belgium was a Belgian national. I mean, it just keeps, yeah. The German, I believe the German was a German national. So it's that's what happens.
Yeah. So I know what the right wingers out there are screaming into their sets right now, or actually started screaming the minute we started the video, no matter what we were going to say, which is, yeah, but you guys are leaving out the fact that they're Muslims, and that's the real problem. But by that definition, right wing terrorism in America is a significantly larger problem than Muslim terrorist attacks. That's a fact. That's a fact by our own government, Department of Homeland Security, et cetera, that they have killed far more people. There's been far more attacks. So is it helpful to say, okay, it's the right wing. And so now they're Americans, kind of, but yeah, they're right wing Americans.
Yeah.
And we should label them as such and make sure we act accordingly. No, it smears all of the right wing, and that's not necessarily fair. And the same, of course, applies to Islam when you take some individuals who did it and apply it to 1.6 billion people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing, like, we shouldn't be surprised by this and how it changes over time. Nobody thinks about murdering people and like gets weapons over the course of a year or two, comes up with a plan. Like, this guy apparently had some sort of map with different police departments marked off on it. This is a guy that's wanted to kill cops for more than a decade. Nobody does all of that, and all during that time reads no books, goes to no websites, has no philosophical interest, talks to no group. Like, they all either, if they're in America, they're likely to be interested in the sovereign citizen movement, or they go to white supremacist websites. If they're Muslim, it might be some sort of affiliation there. That's what criminals do. They could be involved with gangs. They're never just so, they don't just go home and then sit in a chair and stare at the wall before their act of violence. They have affiliations, but as you said, we find some affiliations to be more interesting. We find some affiliations to be more damning, and so we stress them, whereas in other cases we don't. And it doesn't have to be purely, it doesn't have to be religion. If somebody shot up a school and was really into violent video games back in the 90s, that's what a lot of the coverage was about. It doesn't matter if they also had coloring books. There's certain things we focus on and certain things that we don't focus on. Some just have more immediate political, I guess, cachet these days.
And but can also, I just pause there? Because I think, John, that's exactly the point of this story, right? Which is that, what are the consequences? What are the, as we started talking about, right? And what are the decisions we're going to make out of this? So, for example, in the US, when there was this huge IRA terrorism going on in the UK and in Northern Ireland, UK, there was plenty of propaganda against the Irish, right? In America, there wasn't. There's a lot of Irish in America, and it wasn't like, IRA, when are we going to bomb the Irish? Look, it is intrinsic to the Irish personality to be this violent. It is obvious, look at them. They're the most violent people on earth. At that point, they probably were, right? Not because they're Irish, because of that certain socio-political situation that they found themselves in. But we chose not to do that propaganda.
Yeah.
We are choosing now to do a propaganda about a certain group of people that are doing this. Not the mass shooters, not the right wing terrorists, you know, and you, not the regular murder that's going on, and all these other problems, and a lot of which are much larger problems. Yeah. We're choosing to do propaganda about this so that we can go to Raqqa, so that we can launch those wars, etc. And some folks at home genuinely believe it, and they go, oh, no, they were doing that because Islam is a unique, intrinsic problem, yada,
well,
yada.
The other problem that, you know, especially Muslims in America face is that there are so few of us. So if you're trying to talk about 3.5 million people as if everyone practices the religion the same way and feels the same way about it, you're never going to get there. Yeah. But it's a lot easier to otherize a group that is smaller, you know, that doesn't have the same political voice or impact or power that other voices have. You can't look at Dylann Roof and say, well, there's something in the Christian religion here that propelled him to do that, and not expect Christians all over America to say, no, that's not what our religion is about, right. Which is the same thing Muslims have been saying, but in smaller numbers with a smaller voice.
And there are differences, too. I mean, you talk about the IRA. It was much more localized to, you know, bombings in London and Brighton and different
That's fair.
Parts, of, you know,
yep.
in that part of the world, whereas this has become, you know, I would say an overblown epidemic, but still it's a little bit different.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's fair.
So I want to turn briefly to another angle on this. Obviously, when we're talking about the attack in France, we have to talk about what's going to happen this weekend, because we do have the French election, which has received a lot of international attention in the last few months. Not a lot of attention here in the US, although we've covered it several times. And you had Donald Trump tweeting this, if we could bring it up. Another terrorist attack in Paris. The people of France will not take much more of this. Will have a big effect on presidential election. He was asked, or I believe Spicer was asked this morning, who he backs in this election. And he would not say who. Which is not typically Donald Trump's thing, which makes me think that he's uncertain about how it's going to play out. If he was really sure that Le Pen was going to win, I think that he would say it, because philosophically they do share quite a bit. They've talked before. Now, there is some precedent to think that this could affect the election. We certainly have worries about that when there's the possibility of a terror attack right before one of our elections. But it's a complicated situation, and the polling has been fairly consistent for the past few months, which has led some poll analysts here in the US to say that that has less to do with what people actually believe in France and more to do with massive herding, where pollsters are massaging their results to make them more in line with some of the better known polls. But we also have the different candidates halting a lot of their campaigning and, you know, coming out with statements about what needs to happen in terms of ISIS and the threat that it poses, with them sounding very similar, actually. We need to take the fight to ISIS. Le Pen saying, you know, we need to shut down Islamist mosques across France and also stop foreign travel to some extent, stop the inflow of refugees, which I always find ironic that those calls go out, even though this is, once again, a French national that committed this. I love when policies would have no effect whatsoever on the event that triggered them. But that is going on, and we have less than, I believe, 24 hours until the actual vote. And that is going to have such a strong impact on the future of France and perhaps the future of the EU. The idea that this could happen, and then I love that there can be an attack like this, and who benefits? Well, maybe ISIS benefits a little bit, and the far right in Europe benefits. It's interesting how that works out. Yeah,
or not. I mean,
maybe
not. And
certainly,
and I think
rhetorically, they love it.
Well, but it's not rhetoric changing. You know, it's just it's a catalyzing moment, reinforcing maybe. But yes, it is. But they've had enough time and enough events over which to reinforce that point, which speaks to why Le Pen is doing all right. Fillon is doing okay. You talked about the president not endorsing anybody, but President Obama. You'll remember him. He phoned Macron and said that he's, you know, which makes people think that he's supporting him, which I think is a popular thing overseas. It's still a popular thing to have Barack Obama's, you know, signature on your mailer. So I think that's important stuff.
Okay, I'm going to punch back here, because the right wing instantly politicized these. Now, here in America, if there's a mass shooting, they say, don't you dare talk about politics. Let's wait till it's irrelevant and nobody's talking about it anymore. And
then gun control or.
Yeah, then you could maybe talk about gun control, but nobody's talking about it. So it's a trick, right? And the minute that there's a terrorist attack, they will politicize it instantly. That's it, we got to act. And that's why you got to elect right wingers, and we got to get tough on these Muslims and their mosques, et cetera. Now happening in France, right? Same MO. And the usually liberal response is, let's not politicize, oh, that's unfair, et cetera. And it's kind of complaining. That's not my response. My response is, no, if you vote right wing, it will help the terrorists. Because this is exactly what the terrorists want. Why do you think they did it right before the election? They did it right before the election because they want you to vote for the right wingers, who will then antagonize Muslims in France, who then ISIS thinks might join them. Might join them, whether it's in France or actually go down and fight with them in Syria and Iraq. It's not an accident. They know that they're thrilled when the right wing wins. So don't help the terrorists by voting for right wingers. Because when you do, it continues this cycle of violence. And I got news for you, ISIS loves the cycle of violence.
But this is one of those points where we disagree, that you predicted. It's happening right now. I mean, look, France has been hit by terror attacks plenty of times when there wasn't an election at stake. And this far right populist, you know, nationalist movement is not just unique to France. This has been happening all over Europe. And to your point earlier, it doesn't necessarily move elections, right? You saw what happened in the Netherlands, where you had Wilders on one side pushing the exact same agenda that Le Pen has been pushing. And this, what's going to happen in France is going to be interesting to see, because this is really what the country is about. This will rely on French people turning up and saying, we're either with the center or left candidate, Macron, we're going to say, this is, we want inclusiveness and tolerance, or we're really scared. And we really want to kind of hunker down, and our socioeconomic fears and our nationalist fears are real and big enough that we're going to go with Le Pen.
So just to address that real quick. So number one, of course, there's been attacks throughout, right? Mm. But this is the one, as we talked about earlier in the show, that is most connected to ISIS. They took responsibility quicker. There was apparently some communication
just
ahead of time.
They took responsibility. We don't know that.
No, I know. It's not a certainty.
That link yet.
It's not a certainty, but for the moment being, it appears based on the information we have that it is more connected to ISIS than some of the other attacks.
Or at the very least, they want people to think it is. That's right. Why they came out so fast.
They're politically naive.
That's true. But they did it faster.
They're politically naive too, because there's going to be a runoff, so they're wasting it.
they want to push. And Osama bin Laden said the same thing. He's like, look, we want you to attack Afghanistan. We want you to attack Iraq, so you could waste your treasure and you're going to bring the soldiers for us to kill. It makes it so much easier on us, right? So they tell you, it's very obvious, you know, some on the right say, well, if they tell you that they're doing it because of Islam, you should believe them. Well, when they say, we want the right wingers to win in your country so we can have more wars, you should believe them. And that's why this happened, I think, today. Not to say that it's the only reason. Yes, there's been many attacks throughout.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're going to have to take our first break. But when we come back, we're going to have an evaluation of the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency. Was it a success? Should it even be questioned whether it's a success or not? We're going to talk to Donald Trump and find out about that when we come back from this.
All right, back on the Young Turks. I believe you guys came into Little Deucey, which could have several different
right,
meanings.
It's true.
Anyway, all right, let me read some tweets for you guys. And by the way, a super chat message from YouTube. This is fun. J.R. McLaughlin says, support Wolfpack, sign the petition, donate to the cause, or better yet, become a volunteer. If you're going to volunteer for only one cause, this is the one that can help the most people, wolf-pack.com. Is it surprising that I read that?
No.
Hit all the buzzwords necessary for that to be in there.
Only slightly less surprising than that you wrote it.
No, I am not, in fact, right. J.R. McLaughlin. Okay. But thank you, J.R.
He just put that name together. People he knows in the news, people he knows that are over there.
Yeah, he's like J.R. McLaughlin, right? Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Jesus Bowling writes in and says...
Okay, Javier Ortiz writes in, they never thought naming it Islamic terrorism would solve the problem. They were trying to set the stage for religious profiling, which unfortunately I think is very true. Anastasia writes in, the back of the House TY t-shirt, that's the one I'm wearing right now, should say unapologetic, outspoken, woken. Well, a woke bae such as myself would agree with that, of course.
Can you call yourself a woke bae?
I'm not
is
sure.
Is that all right?
No, you're
I'm not sure it's acceptable.
PR person to call you that.
Yeah. I'm not sure it's acceptable under any circumstance.
I would just like to say, what is wrong with awakened?
Yeah.
I love the word awakened.
That's yeah, good.
No. No character.
You are so not woke.
Just keep using it.
I'm sure it'll catch on.
Yeah.
All right, one last thing. That's the donors to the journalism drive, tytnetwork.com/go. Only 8 days left, so it is time to panic. So I need you to go right now if you're at home and panic. And then donate a little bit to tytnetwork.com/go so we can hire more reporters. $15 from Barbara in North Carolina. Hey, 1692. By the way, remember at 1750, we're going to hire a new person. And we're pretty close right there. So let's get there. Let's hire one more reporter. And if we get to 2 million, we will hire two new reporters. Ooh, Jeroms. Okay.
Oh, wow. So we're not waiting for the whole thing to hire the two. It's going to be a one and a one. That's a little different. That's very exciting.
It's something like that. Yeah. But the numbers match. And
if we get a quarter of the way there, we'll hire one and they'll half-ass it.
We'll get a temp.
$15 from Barbara in North Carolina, $50 from Katarina in Texas, and $50 from Steve in Hawaii. Thank you, guys.
Can I read one tweet that was sent? We talked about this one here. This is from Lisa Mojica, and she's a big fan of mine, always has been, apparently. She said, corporate media representing! At Michael Shore, better change his panties. the door has opened for him. We talked about this at the break. We just don't get it.
Who gets the door part?
I don't know.
I get that he is corporate. I get that you have randomly decided to criticize him as feminine, okay, even though your name is Lisa. And right. I get that you're a progressive, but that's not the direction I would have gone with. Plus, I literally don't understand it.
It was so easy just to say shill also.
There
was
yeah, how did you leave shill out?
How did you leave shill out? It's amazing.
Michael, your hate tweets are so different from mine. So different.
Okay. Yeah. All right, what's next?
Okay. Donald Trump has a little bit more than a week until the symbolic 100 days in office mark is reached. And already, before he's even reached it, he doesn't seem happy about it. He tweeted this, "No matter how much I accomplished during the ridiculous standard of the first 100 days, and it has been a lot, including SC, I think he means the Supreme Court pick, media will kill." Man, they really are the enemy of the people. They're going and killing people now. So he says their 100 days as a standard is ridiculous. Why would you use that? I say to him, why did you use that? Because he has. He released a video not too long ago listing some of the legislative accomplishments he intended to get in his first 100 days. The video began like this.
"Today, I would like to provide the American people with an update on the White House transition and our policy plans for the first 100 days.
Weird. They also tweeted this. If we could go to the first tweet. You're going to see Trump lays out policies for first 100 days in White House. So that was an article, but he gladly retweeted it. Apparently, he thought it was okay when the New York Post was using that standard. Also, this in reference to one of his rallies. Now, if we could go back to 7A.
Although I like that part.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're missing one, unfortunately. But anyway, we pulled out a few representative ones. He'd repeatedly tweeted about this 100 days standard. And of course, look, he's used this. He's referenced it in his speeches. It doesn't really mean anything. And I have a feeling if Ben Mankiewicz was here, he would hate the fact that that we use 10 as an important number, that 100 days really matters at all. But it's a standard that Trump himself has used. Now, we're going to be evaluating here in this video whether it has been a success or not, I suppose. But we also have Sean Spicer, who was asked at a press briefing earlier today about this. Now, we've included the question being asked, and I want you to very carefully listen to how the question is framed and then evaluate how Spicer chooses to respond.
Looking ahead to the 100-day mark and setting aside executive orders, can you say what the single piece of legislation that you are proudest that you got through Congress that was on the president's agenda?
Well, a few things on that. Number one, we're not done. We've got a little ways before we hit the 100-day mark. So I think what you've seen out of this White House is a very robust agenda of activity. There's a lot of executive orders that I think the president's been pleased with, not only what they've done or what they will do, but what they've done. I think when you look at immigration in particular, we see a very significant drop at the border. I think on jobs, there's been a lot of activity that we've been very proud to see, American manufacturing and job creation. But then there's pieces like what we did today that I think if you're a veteran who's served our country, to know that you have additional options to get health care in a timely manner, or not just a, but a geographically friendly manner, so you're not driving hours, is very helpful and a strong symbol of how we treat our veterans. There's a lot of things that I think the president's done on veterans, on immigration, on regulatory reform. As I've mentioned here, we're now at a dozen Congressional Review Act pieces of legislation that have been signed that have had, I think, a very positive impact and will have a very positive impact on job creation. And I've noted before to you that only one had ever been signed in history before. That's a pretty significant achievement for this president. And obviously, when you look at the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, it's another significant one. But there's a lot. And again, we'll obviously spend some time talking about this next week. But I think we're very pleased with what the president's accomplished. And, you know, as he noted yesterday in Wisconsin, the amount that he's done overall has been significant.
So the question was, not talking about executive orders, what one piece of legislation can you point to? He immediately said, we're not done, we still have time. And then he smiled in a way that he knew what he was saying there. He then went on to list a number of executive orders. He referenced that they got someone on the Supreme Court, which is true. Mm-hmm. Although I feel like we should acknowledge that they had to use the nuclear option to do it. They couldn't even get it through in the normal way. Seems relevant. And then they talked about executive orders. I don't know that there was a single piece of legislation actually referenced there. I mean, he even went so far as to say companies are doing well, there's economic activity, going to that thing of Trump where if a company says that they're going to invest money or if they're hiring people, even if they've been, if they announced it originally 2 years ago, that's his now. Again, not legislation, but that's what they chose to point to.
Can I just go, October 24th, this Donald Trump said, he tweeted out when he was running, he said that I will, my contract with the American voter will restore honesty, accountability, and change to Washington. And at that point, he put out his 100-day plan, 10 things. Middle class tax relief and simplification, not done. End the offshoring act, not done. American Energy and Infrastructure Act, not done. School Choice and Education Opportunity Act, not done. These are all things that he said he was going to do in 100 days. Repeal and replace Obamacare Act. I guess that was done, right? Affordable Child Care and Elder Care Act. End illegal immigration. Restoring community. You get my point. He listed all these things. They have listed them as the days have gone on. As this is before he was elected. And nothing. There's zero that he's done, except, as you said, executive orders, which today, and we'll probably get to it later, he turned into executive memorandum, which are sort of indistinguishable from executive orders. It's the least effective, and you're right, 100 days, historians hate it, Ben probably hates it, it doesn't really make a great deal of sense. But when you run on it and you talk about it from day one, you're held to it.
Yeah, no, it does make sense, because everybody knows what the president does on the 101st day doesn't count. So, of course, it's an absurd standard, and then the media gets way too hyped up about it. Look, he tried to kill Obamacare, he couldn't do it, okay.
And they might try again next week, actually.
And they're gonna try again, right? And so, if you're his supporter and he does it on day 107 as opposed to day 98, do you really care? You don't really care. If you're his opponent, you equally don't care. But on the issue of hypocrisy, all the things that Michael listed were acts that Trump said he was going to do, hence legislation. They didn't do any of that. So that goes partly to incompetence. He was supposed to be a great manager, he's a business guy, and he was going to get all this, and he's a deal maker. He was going to make deals and get this legislation passed. They tried on one thing and failed. The other nine, to my understanding, they haven't even tried any of those acts.
We're getting closer on taxes, but not yet.
But not even Mnuchin this week said, well, we're not going to get to it before the August recess. Mm-hmm. I mean, so yeah, he was charged with something today, but they're not close.
Although he said today also something is coming next week. We don't know what that's going to be, right. Or if it will be at all. But to your larger point, no, on that hit list of 10, he hasn't hit them all. But let's give credit where credit is due. It's not the border wall, but when it comes to immigration, it's sort of death by a thousand cuts right now. Like a lot of the policies they put into place through the Attorney General's office, through the Department of Homeland Security, have absolutely had the kind of impact that he wanted to have when it came to the border security.
Yeah, and by the way, so further credit to Trump, if you're in his camp, he also, not only the crackdown on illegal immigration, but he did get rid of regulations on coal mining. Right. Now that might create a lot more pollution around there and might endanger the coal miners, but he said he would do it and he did do it. So if you voted for him, I guess you're happy about that. And one thing that is actually positive, he did, for at least for the moment being, pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So I'm happy that he did that, and he had promised that to the right wing, and both right wing and left wing are happy with that. I tend to think he'll get back in, right? But for the moment being, credit where credit is.
But that's also not legislation, so that's
exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's what's so interesting about it is that the legislation, at least the big ticket stuff that he promised, the stuff that was labeled as populist, even if its effect was not actually populist, he wasn't able to do. He got the Supreme Court, but only by perhaps irreparably having the rules changed in his favor. He's done the executive orders, which you can just do. You have wide latitude as the American president to do it. And even some of his most signature achievements in that are being held up in court or were already struck down by judges. And so he's dealing with that right now. That doesn't mean that he has not been a success. It just depends on from whose point of view you're evaluating it. If you're one of the crazy xenophobes supporting him, then you might be frustrated that he hasn't done more to build a wall and, you know, shut out foreigners and scary people and all that. If you believed that he was going to make these populist economic moves, if you thought that getting rid of Obamacare would actually help people, then he hasn't been a success on that measure. But if you're a wealthy CEO or one of the richest people, you're still looking forward to the possibility of tax reform. He has stocked his cabinet with people who are 100% friendly to your point of view. And so there, especially with the way that they've hamstrung future regulations on corporations until that's struck down, he might well be seen as a success for some of the far-reaching but less publicized executive orders that he has gotten through.
Yeah, if you're Republican donor, you're thrilled with how Trump's doing so far. So far hasn't nuked anyone and hasn't done any trade wars, and those are things you were concerned about with a guy this unstable. And so far he's promising you a ton of tax cuts, and he's already given you deregulation. And today in the news, there's even more deregulation coming if you're a Wall Street banker. And then he filled his cabinet with Wall Street bankers.
Yeah.
So Wall Street is probably ecstatic and high-fiving about the first 100 days. So it just kind of depends on who you are, if you're happy or not.
And let's just check in, if we could bring up graphic 7B, you're gonna see the popularity at roughly this point in past presidencies. And well, by that measure, he's not doing well. 35% is probably not where he saw himself ending up, but I'm sure he'll console himself with a brief browsing of Rasmussen, which is gonna be a little bit more favorable for him.
But to be fair, I mean, was Obama much better? Oh yeah, he was. 61%. Much better.
Oh my God, he's lower than Carter, that wussy.
I know, but come on, to be fair, were other Democrats, like the very unpopular Lyndon Johnson, 76%. But how about Kennedy? I mean, 73%.
Well, interestingly,
but Jimmy Carter, what a weakling, loser, yeah. Democrat. 72%.
Bill Clinton's still higher than him there, but would become more popular several years later.
Well, there was also an era where people liked the presidents a lot. So you saw those first three, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Nixon, and Johnson. Everybody liked them. They're all popular presidents because people just liked the president.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not so much anymore.
No, not so much.
And you say era, but the last president was Obama, and he was at 61%.
Right.
So
yeah,
it might also be Trump. Okay, what's next?
Okay, let's do an update from a story we talked about a little bit earlier on this week. This week it was revealed that Exxon was going to be applying for an exemption to the US sanctions currently in place against Russia that would allow them to resume an oil deal, a set of deals actually, with a Russian oil company that could be worth literally trillions of dollars. And that, from a number of points of view, and especially here from TYT's point of view, was one of our big fears. I mean, that's a huge amount of money theoretically being handed over to people who are already corporations who are well represented in the Trump administration because of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. However, at least at present, it looks like they're not going to get what they want. This statement was put out by the Treasury Secretary saying, in consultation with President Donald J. Trump, the Treasury Department will not be issuing waivers to US companies, including Exxon, authorizing drilling prohibited by current Russian sanctions.
So two things here. One, I am legitimately shocked. And two, it appears I am massively wrong. So doesn't happen often. But this is almost as wrong as I was about Anthony Weiner.
You may want to screen grab that, by the way. I didn't mean just, not the Anthony Weiner part. We know that.
There's been enough screen grabbing of that.
Exactly, thank you.
So my thesis was that, hey, you don't put Rex Tillerson as your Secretary of State unless the whole point was to make sure that, and you have all this Russia helping you in the elections, the deal seems obvious here. What do they care most about? Sanctions, the oil deal. This particular deal with Exxon is a $500 billion investment and potentially trillions in revenue. So I concluded that it was that if he had any deal with the Russians, and I thought he probably did, it was about this. Now Treasury saying that they are not lifting the sanctions. Well, then it is entirely possible that I am wrong. It's not over, and this might be, hey, let's let it cool down and we'll let him do it later. But Exxon does have a contract that runs out at the end of the year.
Yeah.
So if they're gonna do it, they have to do it by the end of the year. So until this gets reversed, for the moment being, I appear to have been totally wrong about that deal.
I largely agree with that final point, but earlier on you said Treasury announced they're not lifting the sanctions, but that's not what this is actually. It's that they're not gonna grant a waiver right now to any US companies, and that's why, look, it's great. They could have just let Exxon do it, and that'd be worth trillions for them, as we've been saying. That would be horrible, obviously, and it seemed like one of the big goals of the administration. But what Russia truly wants is not a waiver for Exxon. What they want is to get rid of the sanctions, all the sanctions. And simply giving a waiver to Exxon, they could have tried to do it, they could have done it, but that would be perhaps draw a little bit too much attention. If instead you simply get to a point where, as part of some larger deal with Russia, perhaps having to do with Syria, you get rid of all of the sanctions, well then Exxon wasn't given any special treatment in that. They just were, there was a consequence of getting rid of the sanctions. That is the huge payday. They could have taken the easy route, but this might be just them playing the long game.
And a lot of people, another reason why I think, you know, what that stuff that Johnson just said is really important, but one of the reasons that I was wrong too is that I thought that by deferring to Treasury, because any department could issue the waiver, they deferred to Treasury because Rex Tillerson said, hey, you know, for 2 years, I'm not going to get involved with any of these things once I take this job. Right, right. So we all believe that. But then when Treasury, he gave it to Mnuchin and the Treasury Department was like, oh, that's his out. That's the loophole. I'm not going to do it. They're going to do it. And then they didn't do it. But I know it must be because of what you said, John, because it's not just this black and white.
Well, but to their credit, too, I mean, we're playing this out, how this might have unfolded. This is a plan that Tillerson drafted when he was at Exxon, right? Yeah. It would have gone against the existing sanctions. The tangled web of like players involved in this, the outrage would have been enormous. Like no one in their right mind would have tried to push this through right now. Whether we can speculate about long game or not, I think they finally sat back and said, "There's no way we should."
If we assume outrage matters anymore, but are they affected? But people are going to be outraged. I'm not going to do it. I don't see that anymore.
Well, so just to 2 points of context there, the people who would have been outraged would have been Republicans and not just Democrats. Of course, they don't care about Democrats or liberals. Yeah. But John McCain tweeted on whether they should get this waiver, quote, "Are you crazy?" So
of course, he also voted for Rex Tillerson.
Right. And he voted, and Rubio was against it, and other leading Republicans were against it.
And Rubio voted for him, too.
Yeah. They all voted for Tillerson, but now saying, hey, don't give Exxon the waiver. And it's not that we care that Exxon makes the trillions of dollars. The whole point is Rosneft and the Russian oligarchs. Yeah. And Putin were going to make trillions of dollars off of it. That's why they would have been incentivized to help Trump win. And that's where it's relevant to all of us as a country.
Well, can I go on the record as saying I don't want that oil taken out of the ground at all by any corporation?
That's also,
that's a ridiculous amount of oil that doesn't need to be burned.
Yeah. And then finally, do I really believe I'm wrong? Of course not.
Really?
He almost had me.
Yeah, so I do believe they will lift the sanctions at some point in the nick of time for ExxonMobil and Rosneft to make that deal. But for the moment being, I'm telling you that right now they didn't lift it. And so the facts in front of us is that that right now they didn't give the Exxon that waiver. So if it continues and they never lift the sanctions, then I will come out and say, definitively, that was not the deal.
I also want to go on the record. I was wrong. This is just in case Editor Mary is watching. It's Rosneft. Well, I believe.
I was just going to say how good the first Rosneft that you said was great. I was impressed by you.
I got a lot of criticism after the last story.
You think Trump's the only one with Russian dudes?
Rosneft.
Okay, let's take a quick break here and move on from this whole being wrong nonsense.
I like how you left a lane to be open, though.
Yes.
You're like, it's going to come back. I'll be right.
Well, look,
over a long enough timeline, he's always right.
No, that's why I mentioned Anthony Weiner. Very skeptical that he had actually sent those tweets.
Next president of the United States, Anthony Weiner.
No. It doesn't matter. He sent the tweets, so that is irrevocably wrong.
True. Okay.
Far less important thing.
Yes, a little bit. Okay, when we come back, you want to talk about things that people are wrong about. First off, Trump now going again to help the bankers, so there will be no credit given there. And then a huge fight over Bernie Sanders, both in the press and perhaps here. I don't know. We'll see. We'll be right back.
Disappointing.
All right, back on the Young Turks. Jen Huger, Michael Schur. Amnon Nawaz with us today from ABC News. And John Iderola. By the way, Amnon, I didn't give you enough credit for being part of NBC's investigative unit when you were in Islamabad. And we did that little raid on a guy named Bin Laden, I believe.
We didn't do it. I had nothing to do with that.
Yes, no, you didn't.
Fair.
To be fair. And
plus,
you covered
it's a false flag.
Of course, obviously. I'm going to take my shirt off. Okay. Plus, covering the attack on Malala, who was our first Turk of the Year. We gave her an award for courage, et cetera, back then.
Wow.
Yep. And the first foreign reporter in North Waziristan, which is very, very courageous of you. Here's where you're not going to catch me. Okay, North Waziristan.
Very well done. That was very, very well done. And although I was 4 months pregnant at the time.
Wow.
When I realized. So technically, my first daughter has also been to North Waziristan.
Well, technically, your first daughter, technically, more brave than me. Okay, John, what's next? Oh, sorry, I meant to read the donors as I always do. My bad. $50 from Antonio in New Jersey, $127 from John in Pennsylvania, and $250 from D in California. Can I see where we are now? TYTnetwork.com/go. 1693.
Look at that.
Okay.
Look at that. I want to see 50,000 individual donors. That's what I want.
Oh, I see. Because we've had 49,788 donations.
Oh, that would be cool. Yeah, 12 more donors. What is it? 212 more donors.
Yeah. I thought you were saying
American map. Yeah. Right there. Sure.
But I could tell you where every state is. I just couldn't add all 50 of them together.
I thought you were saying you wanted a $50,000 donation, which I agree with you.
Sure.
Yes, sure. We would like that as well. You could have all the cameras in the studio. So you can't actually take them home. We are naming the cameras. Yeah. 5,000 a pop. You take all the cameras, all be named John, whoever, or whatever your name is, Bob.
Right? Just label them. Just a little sign.
Yeah, we do. They're actually on there. You see that?
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
See, we're not playing.
Yeah. How about this? $50,000, you get to name the next TYT employee child.
Okay, no, that's ridiculous.
Okay. That's crazy money. Come on.
The next TYT child born in North Waziristan. Right.
We already had a bad time with that last time when we offered it. They named Cenk's first son. It was like,
Prometheus. Jesus Christ. What did you guys do to me?
By the way, we got a response to from the tweet last time very quickly. TYT Live. Amwa is from ABC News, hence the corporate media thing. It wasn't about me.
Oh, it's about me.
Yeah, so congratulations. Oh, okay. But it's not me. It was cryptic, but I am a hill bully.
Oh, you're a hill bully.
Wait, but you were still in that tweet, though. I was in that tweet. I was the only person in it. But so I think it was just a general lament. The but hill bully. Nobody's ever called me a bully, ever.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, that's true. Michael, not much of a bully.
No.
And then the tweets sent in were the Mad Lib, doing things one promises to do is a ridiculous standard, quoting Donald Trump. Norma says, it's only been 100 days, feels like 100 years. I'm right there with you, sister. And then Jessica Allison says, Trump can't allow the Exxon deal to go on right now. The heat is too high. I wouldn't say Cenk is wrong yet. No. Well, I'm also with Jessica. Here. Excellent point, Jessica.
Of course you picked that tweet.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Of course.
Also, Jessica Allison wrote that tweet.
An old friend of J.R. McLaughlin's.
Okay, next up. The next set of Donald Trump's executive orders were revealed today, with some taking aim at some of the financial regulations set up in the wake of the Great Recession, and others perhaps setting the stage for his next big legislative battle over tax reform. Trump is scheduled to sign two presidential memos ordering 6-month reviews of the 2010, this is the financial regulation, law's authority for regulators to designate large firms as a risk to the financial system and to try to shut them down with minimal collateral damage. They're on the verge of failing. So one is being able to identify banks that pose systemic risks to the rest of the economic system of the United States. And the other is a system whereby money would be temporarily put into those banks so that there could be a process of sort of orderly liquidation of those banks, which some believe is another form of bailout, basically, like a backdoor bailout to some extent. And so this is not getting rid of those regulations, but this is, as with other Trump executive orders from early on in the year, a review process that has as its natural conclusion possibly getting rid of those regulations. Now, we had a big debate during the Democratic primary about how much stronger those regulations should be in terms of perhaps preemptively taking apart some of those banks that were, quote, too big to fail. They might be going in a very different direction here, getting rid of the ability to classify them in that fashion at all.
Yeah, so some of these points are arguable, although it's not that interesting an argument. Some of them are what they plan to do is horrible, of course. So let me distinguish. So when they say, hey, look, if we say a bank or a financial institution is too big to fail and we will have an orderly way of dissolving them, does that give that bank a little bit of an advantage because the people who put their money into that bank or financial institution know that it is a little bit more protected? Actually, a little bit. And so that's an interesting point to make. But on the other hand, we also have FDIC that protects banks. And that means the main point of that is to protect consumers. So if you have up to $250,000 in a bank, well, that's going to be protected. Now, Bob sets up his own financial institution in his backyard. It's not FDIC protected. The FDIC protected banks have an advantage over Bob. That's true. On the other hand, we kind of like having consumers protected and not have their money disappear. And it's very important to the world order and economy, etc., that some of that money be protected by the government and that for the, to the point of consumers. Okay, so that's the arguable one, but still I think they're very wrong about that, because if things go south, believe me, you want your money in the bank protected, okay? So the one that's not arguable is, well, you know, these systemically important financial institutions, labeling them that way and making sure that they don't take outsized risk and doing more regulations, mm-hmm. we don't need that anymore. Besides which, it was actually helping the bankers. No, it wasn't, okay? It was trying to make sure they don't take too much risk and blow up the economy again. Like, for example, MetLife is a financial institution, not a bank. And did they want to be a financially important, systemically important financial institution? No, they hated it because it doesn't allow them to take more risk. So they fought a tooth and nail. So when they pretend that this is to somehow keep a check on the financial institutions, the facts are completely the opposite. No, the banks love them getting deregulating like this so they can take that more risk. Yeah. And we know what happens when bankers take too much risk. 2008 happens. That's a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah. Big picture on this though, like no one should be surprised, right? Because Mr. Trump ran on a campaign of unraveling all of President Obama's signature efforts. We saw it with the Affordable Care Act. We're still seeing it with the Affordable Care Act. Dodd-Frank was another one of those. So that should not come as any kind of surprise for anyone, right? And if you supported that, you probably like this.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. So of course that's true because he did say that, oh, Dodd-Frank's terrible and yada, yada. But he also said that he was gonna drain the swamp. He also said that Goldman Sachs controls Ted Cruz and Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton was way too cozy with Wall Street. Well, Hillary Clinton would not have done this, and she would have done many other things that were pro-bank. That was why I was against her in the primary and stridently so, right? But this is way more helpful to Wall Street than anything Hillary Clinton would have done. And so, and it helps to grow the swamp. And then Donald Trump wound up putting all those Goldman Sachs guys into his administration and other bankers as well. So I think the Trump voters were a little confused. They're like, oh yeah, the regulation is terrible. And I wanna drain the swamp and make sure the bankers are more powerful.
Well, and also there's sort of-
You think they're confused?
Maybe. There was sort of a two-pronged way that for some reason people believed that he would be hard on the banks. It never made sense to me, but there's two reasons why some people believed it, I think. One, that Hillary Clinton and her speeches seemed super cozy. And then you had Trump making a couple of references to getting rid of the exemption for carried interest. And so he's gonna tax the bankers, which he's already announced he's not going to do now. And so the idea that this guy who's lived in New York, who's surrounded by those people, those are the people at his clubs, the people that he associates with, that he was gonna be harder on them, that was just ridiculous. And in terms of, we've been sort of, we warned ahead of time the various ways that Trump posed a massive risk were he to become president, and we've been seeing some of them. I didn't expect that we'd be on the brink of nuclear war with North Korea, but we have that, so that's cool. And then in terms of economic risks, yes, he hasn't said that he's going to default on the US debt yet. So we've dodged that bullet for now. But this, saying this tiny bit of protections we had after the Great Recession, we're gonna get rid of those. That brings us a step closer to the second recession possibly. And then earlier this week with David Sirota, we talked about them delaying the implementation of the fiduciary rule. The idea that any sort of added responsibility on the part of bankers, where they have to think about anything other than their own short-term financial interests, he's getting rid of that. And so you take away the oversight on the banks, you take away any regulation on the bankers, and you get us right back into the situation we were in before the Great Recession. And that should be scary. Now, we also have executive orders on taxes, so let's turn to those.
Executive memos, John.
Well, this one's an order, apparently, but maybe it'll become a
There's
memo.
There's no real
perhaps.
Difference. There's exactly. little tiny difference.
What about actions?
Actions,
those are slightly different.
There you go.
Trump will also sign an executive order to review significant changes to the tax code since the start of 2016 to determine whether they, quote, impose an undue financial burden on American taxpayers, add undue complexity, or exceed statutory authority. And bear in mind, this is from the party that says that the tax code should be able to fit on a single piece of paper. So God knows what it takes to qualify as undue complexity. But let's talk about one of the particular areas that they're gonna focus on. And then think about how this affects you as an individual taxpayer. That review will include rules enacted by the Obama administration to crack down on so-called inversions in which companies shift their headquarters abroad to reduce their US tax bills. And thank God, because it took a populist like Donald Trump to help you out and give you the authority to do corporate inversions again.
Yeah. So look, a simple way of explaining corporate inversions is it allows corporations to hide their money offshore. So it's a little oversimplistic to describe it that way, but it allows them to avoid taxes here in the US. And that's the only point of a corporate inversion. The only point. There is no legitimate point to a corporate inversion. Okay, if you have subsidiaries abroad, we've always had subsidiaries abroad. That's not the point of the inversion. It is a tax rule to avoid taxes. So did you think when you were voting for Trump that he was going to make sure that multinational corporations can use foreign countries to avoid US taxes? Is that what you bargained for?
Yes, I did. Oh.
Okay. Well, if it's what you bargained for, and there are a handful of people who did bargain for that, well, they're super happy. They gave me probably a little bit of a donation, and then they got huge about billions of dollars in tax breaks back. For the rest of us, we just got hosed.
Yeah.
Because that could have gone towards schools, hospitals, bridges, roads, etc. And it's not going to go to any of that. It's going to go right back in the pocket of the multinational corporation executives.
Yeah.
There's a couple of points off this, though. One is that in the languaging, the administration is very smart about this now, right? When they're messaging and they're talking about this, they always pair these proposals with the idea that everyone can agree on, which is that the tax code is way too confusing and burdensome. And everyone's like, yes, I can get on board with that, fix it. But the other part we haven't talked about is that the tax reform part of their proposal had to come chronologically after healthcare reform, right? Which we haven't really moved on. And I haven't quite heard from anybody how they're going to introduce that without first getting healthcare out of the way.
And the political part of that too, which is a great point, is that you're going to need the Freedom Caucus for tax reform, and they're with you. But if you can't get the healthcare through the Freedom Caucus, they're not going to be as incentivized on the tax reform, because it's all part of the same deal. And you know, it becomes a very complex thing for the White House in dealing with Congress. Today, Mark Meadows, who's the head of the Freedom Caucus, the House Freedom Caucus, a very conservative, stridently conservative group in the House, met with Susan Collins, who it may have been yesterday, but we'll just go with, you know, in the past 24 hours, to try and work something out on health care. Susan Collins is nowhere near where the Freedom Caucus is. So you could see the House and Senate trying to do something independent of the White House, which, as we've predicted for a while, and I have for a while, it's going to take a separation by the Republican Congress from the Republican White House in order to see Trump really struggle and this White House really struggle. And that may be what's happening, and it may be because of what you just said, is that this has to happen first. And if they can't get that to happen, tax reform is going to be difficult. And I think that's why Mnuchin has said, hey, we're going to wait until at least after the August recess to go to tax reform.
Yeah, I'm always so skeptical of that. So last point for me is
skeptical of what?
That they care that healthcare reform be done before tax reform. I mean, Freedom Caucus, everybody's going to agree. Yeah, give the rich and multinational corporations as big a tax break as we could possibly give them, and let's move on.
But if it's intertwined with other legislation and it's a part of a budget too, it becomes an entirely different thing.
There must be a reason. Otherwise, why not do it first? That would be their first incentive. So you're probably right. Just not seeing exactly how that plays out.
Yeah. Turns out, government is complicated. Nobody could have guessed it. I'm waiting for Xi Jinping to sit me down and talk to me about it for 10 minutes.
Okay. All right, 10. Next.
Okay. As we speak, Senator Bernie Sanders is taking part in the, that's the Come Together and Fight Back tour right now with DNC Chair Tom Perez. And so they're doing a number of different rallies and speeches. You might have already seen some of that. But as that's going on, the Washington Post comes out with an editorial by Aaron Blake breaking down some of the reasons that they think that Bernie Sanders' behavior has become weird lately. Some of the things they cite is that he is still not technically a Democrat, which is true and has been true for decades. Suddenly more relevant, I guess. He criticized Hillary Clinton's slogan, I'm with her, recently. He said President Trump did not win the election. The Democrats lost the election, which some people have said in other places too. Sanders' message has, quote, differed from Perez's in a couple key ways. Well, oh my God, they don't agree on everything. And so you take these things and the fact that he wasn't very outspoken in favor of Ossoff in Georgia. And then we have another candidate that he's supporting, which we'll get into in just a little bit. And so they think that it's weird. Cenk, I know that you are very interested in this. Do you think that he's being too weird lately?
So I think I'm going to go for it. I think there's a concerted attack on Bernie Sanders by the establishment. and usually led by the Washington Post, and now led by the Washington Post again. In fact, I didn't quite recognize it until recently. I mean, yesterday the story out of from Slate, where they had this, you want to talk about weird, there's a weird attack on Bernie's podcast. Like, well, this is out of the blue, and it turns out it's not out of the blue. The memo's out by the establishment. We're back to hating Bernie Sanders. So let's break it down. So they say he disagrees with Tom Perez on something. That's a really surprise to you guys, the Washington Post. You guys are journalists, and that's a surprise. Of course he disagrees with Tom Perez on some things. Bernie Sanders says Medicare for all. Most of the establishment Democrats don't say that. They have to push really, really hard to go in that direction. On TYT Politics, Michael Tracy just covered a Dianne Feinstein town hall. You go watch the video for yourself. And Dianne Feinstein is not for Medicare for all. Tom Perez is not for it. So when he's asked, he says, we think healthcare should be a right. What does that mean? Which legislation are you in favor of? I don't want to annoy my donors, so I'm not going to say Medicare for all, because I want to keep taking their money. And Bernie Sanders, still a progressive, still fighting for those things. And so they don't agree. They don't agree. And so, I mean, and it goes down the list. Every single thing that they stated, you're surprised that he thinks that Democrats lost the election. Of course, the Democrats lost the election. They lost to the most unpopular person to ever run for office. Donald Trump was sitting at a 37% approval rating on the day of the election. He didn't win the election. Hillary Clinton lost it. That is not a surprising thing for a progressive to say. So for them to feign like, oh, how dare you, Bernie Sanders? Part of it is definitely Ossoff. And I know that they're mad about that. Mm-hmm. And I get that that's a legitimate fight. I'm on Bernie's side on that, but it's a legitimate fight. But the rest of it is, he won't bend a knee. There he goes again.
Well, but let me just throw this out here for the rest of the conversation. It's that he is being attacked by the establishment, which I think means several different things, but he's being attacked by multiple forms of it. But he's not just being attacked by the establishment. He's also being attacked by libs for being involved in this tour at all. Every time Bernie Sanders does anything with Tom Perez, people start like you hear the murmur a little bit. Oh, is he selling out? Oh, is this Elizabeth Warren during the primary again? And I don't think that there's anything inconsistent whatsoever with him being involved in this effort and trying to organize and rally for the Democratic Party and disagreeing with it. He does want people to come together. It's a unity thing, but he wants them to come together around his positions. He wants to move them in the right direction. That's exactly what he should be doing. And yet I believe he's being attacked from both sides anytime he's seen as being an ally of someone like Tom Perez.
Well, let me ask you a question here. I guess the question is, what is the intention? Like, what is Senator Sanders' intention when you head out on this kind of tour that probably had some kind of mission statement they all agreed to before they decided to go do it? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking back to my high school days, and I played basketball, and I always had this coach who's like, what's your intention? When you go in the paint, you're just going to stand there and wait for something to happen. When you go set a pick, what is your intention? And he was always yelling that from the sidelines. And I look at this behavior, and I just think, yes, you probably think they want him to bring him back online, you know, get everybody on the same page, but why even do the tour then if you're going to be at odds?
You know, and I have a theory on that. By the way, I like your coach. My theory is that Bernie's a really good guy, and I'm going to criticize him here in a sense, that he naively believed that the establishment lost the election. You lost to Trump, and look at all this popularity, and I'm the most popular politician in the country, and I can show you the polling where progressives want, it's not just progressives want, Americans want the progressive policy positions. He naively thought that the Democratic Party could go in that direction, and hence the effort at unity. But Bernie, they're never going to agree, because their whole incentive structure is based around the donors. They can't agree. It's the same mistake that Obama made in a sense, or the press asked Obama to make. Oh, have a beer summit with Mitch McConnell. You're not going to convince Mitch McConnell over a beer. He gets paid to disagree with Obama. And the Democratic Party establishment is never going to agree with Bernie Sanders. So this whole talk of unity is a mirage. So I wouldn't have gone on the tour, not because I don't like Tom Perez, okay, and not because I don't hope for unity, but I know that their financial incentives are aligned against us. So they use unity as a slogan, a punchline, to try to get progressives to just do whatever the Democratic Party wants. Now, if you really meant unity, well, why not unify behind Bernie Sanders, the most popular politician in the country? Isn't that logical? But they won't. They won't do Medicare for all. They won't do his proposals. They just want to use him as a mascot.
Now you're looking at me.
Yeah. go.
There's nothing I have going. I love Bernie Sanders. I think he's great. I think that he's had his day on this stuff. And if he is going to go out with Tom Perez, he should go out with Tom Perez, not cower and not stand down from what he believes, but go do what that mission is. And if not, say no. Say, I'm not going to go out on this tour. I'm not comfortable with it. The way I think with Ossoff, I don't think he should have endorsed Ossoff. But I don't think he should have said, I'm not going to endorse Ossoff. You know, I think he should have just sat that one out. The Heath
Mellon
thing.
Well, he has, by the way, today endorsed him for the next election.
Right. But that's an easier, you know.
Of course, it
would have been better for Ossoff.
Yes.
Ossoff's happy to have him. And he is somebody who commands so much respect from so many voters. And he may, in fact, help Ossoff there. And Bernie has nothing to lose. Because if Ossoff wins now, the progressives can say, hey, look. Bernie endorsed him, and look what happened. Mm-hmm. See, you can even put a Democrat over the line. But I'm sure Tom Perez said, hey, Bernie, you got to do this. And you have to, another thing you have to remember is Tom Perez worked for over a year to not get Bernie Sanders elected. Mm-hmm. He worked with Hillary Clinton for a very long time. They are, they probably see a lot alike. They worked together, I know, on civil rights before any campaign for president existed for either Clinton or Sanders. I know Sanders and Perez worked together. But that's the point here. The Democrats are trying to do something now, do this 50-state strategy. If you can't go all in, whether you believe it or not, you're better off just saying, no, I'm not going to go out there and do this with Tom Perez. And it's easier said than done, I know. But I think that that's what Sanders should have done. I also think that when you inject yourself into the national conversation, as Sanders has done now and has come back into doing, that you set yourself up for whatever criticism that may engender. And there's going to be criticism of that, which is fine. I mean, he's not afraid of that.
Yeah, that's all good. I'm just going to ask the press to do two things, though. Okay, one, don't flip out if Bernie Sanders and other Democrats don't agree. They don't agree.
Yeah.
What's the big deal? And why is it Bernie Sanders' strange behavior? Why is the article's title not Tom Perez's strange behavior? Why did Tom Perez invite Bernie Sanders on a unity tour as the head of the DNC? Didn't he check with him earlier?
Cenk, it's a good idea if you're Tom Perez and you have somebody who's playing.
But why didn't you check? I mean, we just said, why didn't Bernie check?
No, I didn't say why didn't Bernie check. I just said Bernie shouldn't have done it if he didn't want to. It's their tour. He's joining their tour, right? If you're not going to play their songs. I'm not saying you have to. It's not a matter of walking lots. I mean, he's endorsing Heath Mellow for a mayoral candidate in Nebraska, and he's endorsing him even though he's pro-life. So that's not consistent with Sanders' message, but that's okay also.
But to say that it's Perez's party, right?
He's the chairman of the DNC.
No,
that's
he
what
is.
I'm saying.
But who is the most
that's
popular elected politician in that party? Bernie Sanders.
He's not in that party. He caucuses with him.
Okay.
He's an independent.
So if you're going to say, hey, most popular politician in the country, come tour with me, you might want to listen to him. And if you don't listen to him and you didn't plan that out and you have this kind of division, I could argue it's Tom Perez's strange behavior.
Well, I disagree, right? Cenk. I totally disagree. I mean, I think that he is listening to him. The Democrats have listened to Bernie Sanders. Have they done every single thing that Bernie Sanders wanted? Did they nominate him? No, none of those things. But they certainly listened to him.
That doesn't mean a thing.
But you just move on some issues.
Yeah, because
they don't move on the
highest profile. Legislation. Have they moved on legislation? Not at all.
They're the minority party in the Senate.
Medicare for all is real.
But a bunch of Democrats have moved.
Exactly.
Progressives have, after a lot of pressure from Sanders, Conyers, and Justice Democrats.
Which is important. That's what you want. Those are the results you want.
Good. So we're agreeing.
That's what's great about Bernie Sanders. That's what he's doing. They're in the minority party. Are they going to have Medicare for All by a week from Thursday? No, they're not going to. But you have Sanders changing minds, or even if they're not changing minds, he's making other Democrats feel brave about something that we don't think they should feel brave about, should just be doing. That's great.
So we're all agreed. And I hope the media agrees as well. Stop calling what Bernie Sanders is doing strange if he disagrees with Democrats. They disagree, okay, with the Democratic Party. Okay, so we're agreed on that. So the second thing I'm going to ask the media to do is to not assume that the Democratic Party establishment is right in every instance. That is their given assumption. Well, obviously, the Democrats are backing this candidate, so that is the correct candidate. And so, progressive didn't back him. Boo! Weirdo, okay? No, why not assume that the most popular person on that side of the aisle, in fact, in the whole country, the most popular politician in the country, maybe he's correct.
I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's fair because, look, they're not saying that he's necessarily the right, that Ossoff is the right guy. They're saying that this is the guy the Democrats are putting all their money and resources and attention behind. And if Bernie Sanders is out there with the Democratic establishment on this tour saying we're aligned, we're on the same page, and then he doesn't back him.
No, I totally disagree. So let me explain why I'm not. George is a really strange case and not a good example of this because it was a jungle primary. So if you got over 50%,
right,
that made a big difference. You would have won outright. So there, I might even disagree with Bernie Sanders, given where, especially going into the election, it was so close and no other Democrat had a real chance. So I look at that in a pragmatic and situational way. But if it's a regular primary and they say, like what you just said, hey, well, Manchin's got all the money behind him, so you shouldn't oppose him. Oh, hell no, I don't agree. I don't care how much money Manchin, I don't care how much the Democratic Party wants to waste on Joe Manchin, no, we're going to primary him and we're going to have a real progressive run in that race. I never will agree to that. Bernie Sanders should never agree to that. Why do I have to bow my head to corporate money? That's the whole point of being a progressive.
You don't have to, but Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. He's not part of the party.
He's a progressive, much
better. Right, he is a progressive. That's fine. But we're talking about going out with the chairman of the DNC. I'm not saying that he's, you know, that he's not right to be a progressive and not right, that you're not right to field somebody against Joe Manchin. We have our differences as to the efficacy of that, it's smart to do that. But Bernie Sanders, if he's going out with the head of the DNC, it's a little different. I mean, you're buying into something that they're selling, and you have to, I think you don't have to.
Or attempting to sell alongside them and hope that he will listen, hope that they'll see the difference in the crowd's reaction when he's speaking, when Tom Perez is speaking. I've seen those pictures back and forth. And it might be that they do this whole thing, and he was naive, and it has no effect. And you might judge and say, look, it maybe has a 5% chance of working. But sitting on the sidelines has a 0% chance of working. And we could be mad at them for bringing him along and not going along with him. But we'd be madder if they didn't bring him at all, if they totally shut him out.
That's true. And
I think Bernie Sanders has been fighting on these issues, basically the exact same issues, for decades and decades and decades. And there's all these points where someone could look and say, well, you tried up until this point. Why are you still trying? But why stop now? I think that just because Trump won, he's still going to fight for those positions. And a lot of people will say, you gave it your best shot, you lost the primary, you're now wasting your time. We should draft Bernie, or it should be a third party thing. Bernie Sanders understands those options. He understood those options during the last election. He could have run as a third party candidate. You're not going to educate Bernie Sanders about these things. He has been doing this his whole life. He could be wrong in the end, but he has made the decision that however difficult the path is, however long it's going to take, this is the best bet to get his policies actually enacted.
Yeah, and I actually think he's far more practical than people give him credit for.
Otherwise, I agree, that's exactly what he's doing.
That's right, otherwise he would have run as a third party candidate, which is very impractical. That's why we set up the Justice Democrats within the Democratic parties, because you can take over the party. You can actually be progressive and strong and not take corporate money. That is, I think, the correct path, justicedemocrats.com. Anyway, but I'll leave you on this note. There is going to be a war within the Democratic Party. It is unavoidable. This talk of unity is nonsense, okay? One side thinks that they should take the donor money and largely do what the donors want. Now, they'll disagree with that description, but that's the establishment side. The other side does not want to do that. They don't agree. They will fight and one of them will win. This idea of unity is both a fantasy and two, is actually a slogan by the establishment intended to get progressives to bow their heads and just do whatever the moneyed interests want. And we don't agree, and we will never agree. Okay, now let's take a break. Okay, so as we go to this break, the video you're gonna see here is from town hall that happened last night. Jordan Chariton from TYT Politics was in Flint, Michigan. The mayor is holding a town hall, and something outrageous happened. And by the way, all these videos are up on youtube.com/TYT Politics. Please check that out. And we carried it live on Facebook as well. So they started arresting people. And we asked, why are you arresting these folks? They were causing a disturbance. What kind of disturbance? They were too loud. Being too loud in a town hall is now an offense you can get arrested for? I also disagree with that and will never agree with that.